Chapter 7. They entered a moderate-sized apartment indeed. Holywell Street is not above 100 yards long, and this chamber was not more than half that length. It was fitted up with the simple taste of its owner. The carpet was of white velvet laid over several webs of Aubusson, Ispahan, and Axminster, so that your foot gave no more sound as it trod upon the yielding plain than the shadow did which followed you, of white velvet, painted with flowers, arabesques, and classic figures, by Sir William Ross, J.M. W. Turner, R.A., Mrs. Mee, and Paul Delridge. The edges were wrought with seed pearls, and fringed with Valenciennes lace and bullion. The walls were hung with cloth of silver, embroidered with gold figures, over which were worked pomegranates, polyanthuses, and passion flowers, in ruby, amethyst, and smaragd. The drops of dew which the artificer had sprinkled on the flowers were diamonds. The hangings were overhung by pictures yet more costly. Georgian the gorgeous, Titian the golden, Rubens the ruddy and pulpy, the pan of painting, some of Murillo's beatified shepherdesses, who smile on you out of darkness like a star, a few score first-class Leonardos, and 50 of the masterpieces of the patron of Julius and Leo, the imperial genius of Urbino, covered the walls of the little chamber. Divans of carved amber covered with ermine went round the room, and in the midst was a fountain, pattering and babbling with jets of double distilled otto of roses. Pipes, Goliath. Raffle said gaily to a little negro with a silver collar. He spoke to him in his native tongue of Dongola, and welcome to our snuggery, my Kidlingsby. We are quieter here than in the front of the house, and I wanted to show you a picture. I'm proud of my pictures. That Leonardo came from Genoa, and was a gift to our father from my cousin, Marshal Manasseh. That Murillo was pawned to my uncle by Marie Antoine before the flight to Varennes. The poor lady could not redeem the pledge, you know, and the picture remains with us. As for the raffle, I suppose you are aware that he was one of our people. But what are you gazing at? Oh, my sister, I forgot. Miriam. This is the Lord Kidlingsby. As he had been seated at an ivory pianoforte on a mother-of-pearl music stool, trying a sonata of hers. She rose when thus apostrophized. Miriam de Mendoza rose, and greeted the stranger. The Talmud relates that Adam had two wives, Zillah the dark beauty, Eva the fair one. The ringlets of Zillah were black, those of Eva were golden. The eyes of Zillah were night, those of Eva were morning. Kidlingsby was fair of the fair Saxon race of Hengist and Horsa. They called him Miss Kidlingsby at school, but how much fairer was Miriam the Hebrew. Her hair had that deep glowing tinge in it which has been the delight of all painters, and which, therefore, the vulgar sneer at. It was of burning auburn, meandering over her fairest shoulders in 20,000-minute ringlets. It hung to her waist and below it. A light blue velvet fillet clasped with a diamond aigrette valued at 200,000 tomans, and bought from Lieutenant Vikovich, who had received it from Dost Mahomed, with a simple bird of paradise, formed her headgear. A sea-green cymer with short sleeves displayed her exquisitely molded arms to perfection, and was fastened by a girdle of emeralds over a yellow satin frock. Pink gauze trousers spangled with silver, and slippers of the same color as the band which clasped her ringlets, but so covered with pearls that the original hue of the charming little papouche disappeared entirely, completed her costume. As he had three necklaces on, each of which would have dowered a princess, her fingers glistened with rings to their rosy tips, and priceless bracelets, bangles, and armlets wound round an arm that was whiter than the ivory grand piano on which it leaned. As Miriam de Mendoza greeted the stranger, turning upon him the solemn welcome of her eyes, Kidlingsby swooned almost in the brightness of her beauty. It was well she spoke. The sweet kind voice restored him to consciousness. Muttering a few words of incoherent recognition, he sank upon a sandalwood settee, as Goliath, the little slave, brought aromatic coffee in cups of opal and alabaster spittoons, and pipes of the fragrant Ghibli. My lord's pipe is out, said Miriam with a smile, remarking the bewilderment of her guest who in truth forgot to smoke, and taking up a 1,000-pound note from a bundle on the piano, she lighted it at the taper, and proceeded to re-illumine the extinguished chibok of Lord Kidlingsby. IV. When Miriam, returning to the Mother of Pearl music stool, at a signal from her brother, touched the silver and enameled keys of the ivory piano, and began to sing, Lord Kidlingsby felt as if he were listening at the gates of paradise, or were hearing Jenny Lind. Lind is the name of the Hebrew race, so is Mendelssohn, the son of Amunds, so is Rosenthal, the Valley of the Roses, so is Lower Lewis or Lyons or Lyon. The beautiful and the brave alike give cognizances to the ancient people. You Saxons call yourselves Brown, or Smith, or Rogers, Raffle observed to his friend, and, drawing the instrument from his pocket, he accompanied his sister, in the most ravishing manner, on a little gold and jeweled harp, of the kind peculiar to his nation. All the airs which the Hebrew maid selected were written by composers of her race. It was either a hymn by Rossini, a polka by Braham, a delicious romance by Sloman, or a melody by Weber, that, thrilling on the strings of the instrument, wakened a harmony on the fibers of the heart. But she sang, no other than the songs of her nation. Beautiful one. Sing ever, sing always, Kidlingsby thought. Could sit at thy feet, as under a green palm tree, and fancy that paradise birds were singing in the boughs. Raffle read his thoughts. E have Saxon blood too in our veins, he said. Ooh smile. But it is even so. An ancestress of ours made a mésalliance in the reign of your King John. Her name was Rebecca, daughter of Isaac of York, and she married in Spain, whitherest he had fled to the court of King Bobdil, Sir Wilfred of Ivanhoe, then a widower by the demise of his first lady, Rowena. The match was deemed a cruel insult amongst our people, but Wilfred conformed, and was a rabbi of some note at the synagogue of Cordova. We are descended from him lineally. It is the only blot upon the escutcheon of the Mendozas. As they sat talking together, the music finished, and Miriam having retired, though her song and her beauty were still present to the soul of the stranger, at a signal from Mendoza, various messengers from the outer apartments came in to transact business with him. First it was Mr. Aminadab, who kissed his foot, and brought papers to sign. How is the house in Grosvenor Square, Aminadab? And is your son tired of his yacht yet? Mendoza asked. That is my 24th cashier, said Raffle to Kidlingsby, when the obsequious clerk went away. He is fond of display, and all my people may have what money they like. Entered presently the Lord Barrisers, on the affair of his mortgage. The Lord Barrisers, strutting into the apartment with a haughty air, shrank back, nevertheless, with surprise on beholding the magnificence around him. It'll Mordecai, said Raffle to a little orange boy, who came in at the heels of the noble, take this gentleman out, and let him have £10,000. I can't do more for you, my lord, than this I'm busy. Goodbye. And Raffle waved his hand to the peer, and fell to smoking his narghili. A man with a square face, cat-like eyes, and a yellow mustache, came next. He had an hourglass of a waist, and walked uneasily upon his high-heeled boots. Tell your master, that he shall have 2 millions more, but not another shilling, Raffle said. That story about the 25 millions of ready money at Kronstadt is all bosh. They won't believe it in Europe. You understand me, Count Krogomovsky? But His Imperial Majesty said 4 millions, and I shall get the knout, unless, go and speak to Mr. Shadrach, in room Z94 the fourth court, said Mendoza good-naturedly. Leave me at peace, Count. Don't you see it is Friday, and almost sunset? The Kalmyk envoy retired cringing, and left an odor of musk and candle grease behind him. An orange man, an emissary from Lola Montes, a dealer in piping bullfinches, and a cardinal in disguise, with a proposal for a new loan for the Pope, were heard by turns, and each, after a rapid colloquy in his own language, was dismissed by raffle. The queen must come back from Aranjuez, or that king must be disposed of, Raffle exclaimed, as a yellow-faced ambassador from Spain, General the Duke of Alapadrida, left him. "It shall it be, my Kidlingsby?" Kidlingsby was about laughingly to answer, for indeed he was amazed to find all the affairs of the world represented here, and Holywell Street the center of Europe, when three knocks of a peculiar nature were heard, and Mendoza, starting up, said, "Ha! There are only four men in the world who know that signal." At once, and with a reverence quite distinct from his former nonchalant manner, he advanced towards the newcomer. He was an old man evidently too, of the Hebrew race. The light of his eyes was unfathomable, about his mouth there played an inscrutable smile. He had a cotton umbrella, and old trousers, and old boots, and an old wig, curling at the top like a rotten old pear. He sat down, as if tired, in the first seat at hand, as Raffle made him the lowest reverence. "I am tired," says he. "I have come in 15 hours. I am ill newly," he added with a grin. "Et me some au sucre, and tell me the news, Prince de Mendoza. These bread rolls, this unpopularity of Gizet, this odious Spanish conspiracy against my darling Montpensier and daughter, this ferocity of Palmerston against Coletti, makes me quite ill. Give me your opinion, my dear Duke. But whom have we here?" The august individual who had spoken had used the Hebrew language to address Mendoza, and the Lord Kidlingsby might easily have pleaded ignorance of that tongue. But he had been at Cambridge, where all the youth acquire it perfectly. "Sire," said he, "I will not disguise from you that I know the ancient tongue in which you speak. There are probably secrets between Mendoza and your major." "Hush," said Raffle, leading him from the room. "Au revoir, dear Kidlingsby. His Majesty is one of us," he whispered at the door. "So is the Pope of Rome, so is." Dot a whisper concealed the rest. "Gracious powers, is it so?" said Kidlingsby, musing. He entered into Holywell Street. The sun was sinking. "It is time," said he, "to go and fetch Armida to the Olympic." Phil Fogarty. A Tale of the Fighting on the Oneth. By Harry Rolliker. The Gabion was ours. After 2 hours fighting, we were in possession of the first embrasure, and made ourselves as comfortable as circumstances would admit. Jack Delamere, Tom Delancey, Jerry Blake, the doctor, and myself, sat down under a pontoon, and our servants laid out a hasty supper on a tumbrel. Though Cambaceres had escaped me so provokingly, after I cut him down, his spoils were mine. A cold fowl and a bologna sausage were found in the marshal's holsters, and in the haversack of a French private who lay a corpse on the glacis, we found a loaf of bread, his 3 days' ration. Instead of salt, we had gunpowder, and you may be sure, wherever the doctor was, a flask of good brandy was behind him in his instrument case. We sat down, and made a soldier's supper. The doctor pulled a few of the delicious fruit from the lemon trees growing near, and round which the carabineers and the 24th Legion had made a desperate rally, and punch was brewed in Jack Delamere's helmet. "Faith, it never had so much wit in it before," said the doctor, as he ladled out the drink. We all roared with laughing, except the guardsman, who was as savage as a Turk at a christening. "Buvazen," said old Sawbones to our French prisoner, "Sir Cavous Fira du Bean, Mon Vieux Cock." And the colonel, whose wound had been just dressed, eagerly grasped at the proffered cup, and drained it with a health to the donors. How strange are the chances of war! But half an hour before, he and I were engaged in mortal combat, and our prisoner was all but my conqueror. Grappling with Cambaceres, whom I knocked from his horse, and was about to dispatch, I felt a lunge behind, which luckily was parried by my sabretape. A Herculean grasp was at the next instant at my throat. I was on the ground. My prisoner had escaped, and a gigantic warrior in the uniform of a colonel of the regiment of Artois glaring over me with pointed sword. Rentoy, Coquin, said he. Alexandiable, said I. Colin of Fagardi never surrenders. I thought of my poor mother and my sisters. At the old house in Killaloe I felt the tip of his blade between my teeth. I breathed a prayer, and shut my eyes. When the tables were turned, the butt end of Lanty Clancy's musket knocked the sword up, and broke the arm that held it. Thanamandiel Naboclish, said the French officer, with a curse in the purest Irish. It was lucky I stopped laughing time enough to bid Lanty hold his hand, for the honest fellow would else have brained my gallant adversary. We were the better friends for our combat, as what gallant hearts are not. The breach was to be stormed at sunset, and like true soldiers we sat down to make the most of our time. The rogue of a doctor took the liver wing for his share. We gave the other to our guest, a prisoner. Those scoundrels Jack Delamere and Tom Delany took the legs, and, faith, poor I was put off with the Pope's nose, and a bit of the back. How do you like His Holiness's feature? Said Jerry Blake. Anyhow you'll have a merry thought, cried the incorrigible doctor, and all the party shrieked at the witticism. De mortuis nil nisi bonum, said Jack, holding up the drumstick clean. Faith, there's not enough of it to make us chicken-hearted. Anyhow, said I, come, boys, let's have a song. Here goes, said Tom Delany, and sung the following lyric, of his own composition, here Jack, this white mug that with Guinness I fill. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.